welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods.
We've talked a couple of times about chest pain with an episode on biomarkers and an episode on risk stratification scores. But today's topic will be a little bit different. We're going to talk about how you make the most out of an observation stay. You have a chest pain patient who is in the ED, who does not clearly need to go right away to the cath lab, but also cannot be screened as being low risk. What's the optimal setting for them to do their observation period, as well as what should we be doing while they're there? First up, we're going to talk to Dr. Anwar Osborne, an assistant professor of emergency medicine and internal medicine at Emory University, and he is a national expert in observation medicine.
I don't want to do too much of a retread here, but I want to make sure that we're all kind of speaking the English when we're talking about acute coronary syndrome. So the overriding questions is which patients need to stay in the hospital for chest pain evaluation, and where does OBS fit in? In the high-risk patients that have negative troponin, or the troponins that are in the indeterminate range, these patients are excellent candidates for observation medicine care. So what is observation? We talk about observation in a number of different settings. Observation really can be three things, and it's very easy to conflate. So observation can be a place, it can be a science, it can be a status and service, depending on where you read. But when observation is a place, we call it an observation unit. When observation is a science, the science of trying to find an efficient pathway to care for these patients, we call it a protocol. And when observation is a status or a service, we call it outpatient. Observation can occur in multiple different settings. Four, actually. Well, I just want to take a second to break down these different types of observation settings. So these all have a mix of place, the science, and the service. And so a type one observation unit is a protocol-driven patient care in a dedicated observation unit. There's a lot of evidence supporting that this is the ideal way to care for patients receiving observation services. Type two is discretionary care in a dedicated observation unit. And so when people talk about, oh, we're having an open obs unit or the type of place that's a bricks and mortar location, but people can come in and receive whatever kind of care that the provider thinks is appropriate, not protocol driven, often with different types of providers. This is a type two observation unit. And again, people sometimes refer to this in the literature as an open unit. Type 3 observation setting is a protocol-driven patient care in any bed in the hospital. So this a lot of times is called a virtual obs unit. In a particular institution, they may have a protocol for taking care of patients with hyperglycemia that involves like a reassessment and criteria for a discharge based on the blood sugar. But there is not a bricks and mortar location, and these patients can be spread amongst the hospital. And type 4, which is by far the most common observation setting, is discretionary care in any bed in the hospital. So a patient can be in a bed just down the hall or right next to a patient who's receiving inpatient services, and that provider can order whatever test that they think is necessary at the time. So patients a lot of times are confused by this because this happens all the time. They don't know if they're in a particular place and not necessarily on a particular pathway. Again, type 1 pathways or type 1 observation settings have the most evidence supporting their efficiency and use. When you coalesce the resources and you try to combine that with the science of efficiency, and you have providers that are aware of the needs of the observation patient, the outcomes are almost invariably going to be just as good, if not better, for patients in any particular pathway that you choose. We talked about the observation type setting. So what are observation services technically? Obviously, you guys know that the Medicare publishes the hospital manual, and in the hospital manual, in brief, OBS services are the services furnished on a hospital's premises, including use of a bed and periodic monitoring by nursing and other staff, which are reasonable and necessary to evaluate an outpatient's condition or determine the need for possible admission as an inpatient. And every time I read that at a conference, I see people glaze over it. And they're like, oh, that doesn't make sense. So, and this is not to trivialize the things that we do, but to make it simple so that we understand observation services are things, sometimes very important things, like cardiac monitoring or imaging, but they're always things that have to be done in order to determine if there's a need for admission or discharge. So in op services, you have to be doing a thing. You take a patient, and that patient is selected appropriately that can benefit from these things, and that's how you get an observation protocol.
Okay, so we've discussed the different things that observation can be, and that observation services are things that are done to either advance your workup towards a diagnosis or to further treat a patient. Can you talk to us about what goes into an observation protocol?
The three key components of an observation protocol: patient selection, interventions, and you have to be able to make a decision. For instance, this heart pathway would be a very simple way to select patients that would be appropriate.
And just to clarify, here we're talking about using the heart score as a tool.
So patients who aren't appropriate for early discharge, like the high-risk heart scores that have negative troponins or an indeterminate range troponin, they may need additional testing. And those are appropriate patients for the observation unit. And so then, what are the things that people do? That's really, a lot of that's going to be covered in the imaging webinar, which is upcoming. There's a range of possible interventions that are ranging from resting echocardiograms, stress echocardiograms, to myocardial perfusion imaging. Any of those things can help you determine whether or not the patient actually has possible high-grade stenosis or regional wall abnormalities that would lead you to either admit them or discharge the patient. The observation units can be managed by ER physicians. So I would submit that the ER physician is the best person to manage the observation patient, and that works on a number of levels. Now, there's data to support this, but I can tell you this, that the observation patient is a time-sensitive patient, and ER doctors are much more attuned to time-sensitive conditions, not just acute coronary syndromes, but also things like TIA and stroke, envenomations or toxidromes and things like that. So we manage a lot of patients based on a time sort of table. I'm fortunate enough to be able to practice also as a hospitalist, but I can tell you that even though there's a 24-hour hospitalist model, there's not that much incentive to discharge patients when it's very late at night. In the ER, if you come in the ER at 5 o'clock and your workup is complete at 2 in the morning, there's a very good chance you'll be discharged. That's not always the case with inpatients. So observation units really need to be handled in a 24-hour, you can be discharged sort of fashion, and the ER physician, I think, is especially attuned to doing that.
So Anwar, what do these observation models look like? Can you give us an example of how they actually operate?
There's two kinds of models. So there's the one physician model and a two physician model. The ER physician would round at the beginning of the shift with an APP or nurse practitioner or PA who is stationed in the unit there to complete the care. Now in this sort of model, from the provider standpoint, it requires an APP obviously, but the physician time is typically 8 to 10 minutes per patient. In the two physician model, there's a distinct group of physicians that round on the patient. Now, this model may or may not use an APP, and the time per patient is generally 40 to 50 minutes without an APP. The key is, though, in the second group, they may bill under a second or under a separate Medicare ID to bill for an additional H&P. We'll talk about that a little bit more. Now, there's pros and cons to each of these models. So the biggest pro from the two-physician model is it's like admitting to a hospitalist, and there's really more RVUs. The downside of that, though, is that there's probably legal and compliance hurdles with finding a separate Medicare ID. And you're really trying to make two H&Ps, two value and physicals for somebody who's going home in 15 hours. And that may or may not be necessary.
So the way I understand the two-physician model is that the primary emergency physician basically admits a patient to a physician who is just running the observation. Whereas in the one physician model, the primary emergency doctor maintains care of that patient, even though they are under an APP who is administering the observation care.
Now, the one physician model is much more common. It has a structured sign out, it's simpler, lower staffing costs, and there's only one H&P and one discharge summary. Now, the biggest con would be less revenue from the provider standpoint. There's a lot to unpack with how to properly administrate and observation units as far as the facility side and the nursing side. The nursing ratio that we learned is by survey, typically 4 to 1. If you're at about 8 beds, typically there's a PCA or a tech that aids in the patient care from that standpoint. Usually the patients in the observation unit are discharged or admitted later in the midday, and these beds a lot of times remain empty until about 5 or 6. And that's been replicated at multiple hospitals over multiple models. So there is a lot of opportunity to flex these physical obs beds for patients who aren't necessarily the pathway. So there's multitude of other functions that the observation unit bed can perform, like holds for short stay procedures. One of the keys to being efficient in this observation unit is that rounds should occur early, and there should be some type of follow-up to alleviate any sort of roadblock or pending discharges later in the day at about 5 p.m.
We're now going to turn to Dr. Michael Granovsky, who, amongst many accolades, is the national chairman of ASEP's reimbursement committee. And the question that I want to throw to you, Dr. Granovsky, is can emergency physicians get paid for observation care? This is one of the biggest hurdles that we hear brought up all the time.
There are some requirements to report observation services in order for emergency physicians to be paid, and they fall into sort of two categories. One, general documentation requirements, and then some specific requirements that relate to the individual codes that are assigned. The general documentation requirements include four things: a time-dated order to place the patient in observation, that should be clearly noted in the record; a short treatment plan regarding the goals of observation, for instance, for a chest pain patient, low-risk chest pain patient, plan observation, follow-up troponin per protocol; clinically appropriate progress notes, and that's an area that isn't further defined. So a patient with a respiratory complaint, such as asthma, a COPD exacerbation, or croup, might have appropriate reevaluation every several hours, whereas a chest pain patient might only need to be seen once every 6 to 8 hours during more general rounding. And then importantly, and as Anwar said, what's new for us in the emergency department is a short discharge summary and a little bit of a follow-up plan. Now, I mentioned those were the general requirements. Each level of observation then has a different code assigned to it, and they break up into two larger buckets. All the services take place on a single day, in which case there are three codes: low, medium, and high severity, 99234, 99235, and 99236. And then importantly, if you are going to report the codes for a one-day stay, Medicare and many payers following Medicare guidelines require 8 hours of observation on the same calendar date to report those codes that contain the discharge RVUs. And Medicare feels so strongly about it, they've published clear and direct guidance, and it's even one of the items that the recovery audit contractors have focused on, and that's at the bottom of the slide there, the actual RAC work issue denotation. Now, sometimes the patients will be in observation and the care will span two calendar days. So the patient comes in on Monday, they stay past midnight, and they go home Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon. Then there are two different codes to report with different documentation requirements. On that initial day, you would report 99218 and then a discharge code for the rounding that takes place on that Tuesday morning or Tuesday afternoon. And there are some specific requirements. That would include perhaps a final exam, discussion of the observation stay with a little summary, follow-up instructions, and then general documentation. There's often a little bit of confusion because of the two scenarios, so I'm summarizing them here. Low, medium, and high severity care all on the same day, 99234, 99235, 99236. Patient comes in Monday morning, they receive care throughout the day, and go home Monday evening, 8 hours or more later. Now, as we drill down a little bit further on the documentation requirements, it's important to recognize that all but the lowest level of observation patients require very significant history and physical exam documentation, similar to what we would be used to in the emergency department, and then there are some additional requirements. So what encoding nomenclature, it's a comprehensive history and physical exam that's required for the moderate and high severity patients, 99219, 99220 if the patient is spending 2 days, or 99235, 99236 if the patient is only spending 1 day. That involves four HPI elements, three areas of the past family social history. So again, if you're reporting, for instance, an emergency department service, such as a 99285, you might only be required to document the past medical history and the social history. But the observation codes require the addition of a family history. That's an important item to include in the documentation. 10 elements relating to the review of systems and 8 organ systems. And then a quick note to beware of overusing macros for the review of systems and physical exam. But the recovery audit contractors are still looking for case-specific information when documenting them. Patient has pneumonia. Make sure to document your lung findings. Make sure to document those areas of the review of systems in the respiratory system that are relevant to the patient's presentation. Now, what about the RVUs for these services, which ultimately determines the payment levels? As a reference point, the right-hand side of your slide, we're going to show here the RVUs associated with 99284, 99285, 3.32, 4.90. Now, for those moderate and high-severity OBS patients, 99235, 4.78 RVUs, so significantly more than a 99284 for that extra work that's taking place in that longer stay that that patient likely has. And for 99236, the highest level OBS patients, which are common because those high complexity patients represent TIA, syncope, chest pain as typical common examples, 6.16 RVUs compared to 4.90 for your 99285. Then if the patient stays overnight, we discuss the coding construct where on day one, you would report a service from 99218, 99219, or 99220, perhaps as much as 5.25 RVUs for the higher complexity patients that are staying 2 days. And then on Tuesday morning when you round and write your discharge note, you would report 99217, an additional 2.06 RVUs. You put that together and below the table, you can see those 2 day stays, 99217, plus the 99220 for that higher complexity patient, the work done on the Monday, you're up to 7.31 RVUs compared to an ED valuation for the highest complexity patients of 4.90. So a very significant RVU difference between those services.
There was a lot of number soup in there, so let's just pause and reiterate the point that what you're saying is those observation services, if you bill them correctly, will give you a much higher RVU total value than the highest level ER coding that you could have gotten for the same patient.
Now that we know the RVUs and the initial question, which is, can emergency physicians be paid or can these units be profitable? And Anwar mentioned that often there is some support required from the hospital depending on the types of staffing. And Anwar went over using physician staffing augmented by mid-level provider staffing. Let's put some real numbers to it. A 10-bed unit that's turned 1.3 times daily, so about 13 patients coming in and out of the unit, blend of moderate and high, you would be up to a large number of dollars per hour and be in an excellent position to staff that unit fully with a small amount of profit left over.
Now, I know that there have been several news stories out there about Medicare no longer paying for observation status for patients who are not admitted to the hospital. So what do you say to a patient who demands to be admitted because they're worried about the bill? Is that even something that is true?
That's a very important issue as we look at the patient financial considerations. And one of the bigger things to be concerned about is the difference between observation services, which are outpatient services, which are covered under Medicare Part B, and inpatient services, which are covered under Medicare Part A. Under Medicare Part B, patients have an 80-20 coinsurance. And that's an important item that with very long observation stays, which would not be very common in ED-run observation units, that 20% copay can add up. And we'll put some real numbers to it. Additionally, if you're not an inpatient, then you are not moving forward and generating inpatient days towards coverage for skilled nursing facility charges. In the original OIG study, 11% of observation stays were greater than 3 days. And that raised some additional concerns with both the OIG and with Congress. And then the third issue is that self-administered medications are not covered during an outpatient stay. Now, if we look at some of the patient financial detail, those 20% copays can really add up for longer complex ob stays. However, the inpatient expense involves a deductible of over $1,300. And until that Part B 20% copay exceeds the Part A inpatient deductible, in fact, patients are better off being in observation than they are as an inpatient. So that's a little bit of myth and mystery that we've now debunked. The 20% copay under the Medicare fee schedule typically does not exceed what the patient would have paid under the Part A inpatient deductible. The second issue that we brought up was skilled nursing facility. And in ED-run OBS units, those OBS stays are typically 1 or 2 days, particularly under the now two-midnight rule, after which patients typically need to be converted to an inpatient. In the original OIG study, looking at that cohort where 11% of the patients had observation stays past 3 midnights, only about half a dozen of them ever ended up going to a skilled nursing facility. So that is really almost irrelevant. And then if you add the additional litmus test of ED-run OBS units that are generally delivering high-efficiency, protocol-driven care, then the likelihood of that patient needing skilled nursing facility coverage is very low. The third issue, however, is important, which is self-administered medications. Those are fully uncovered services using the outpatient processes available to the patient under Part D. And in the OIG study, the average cost of self-administered medications for the observation patients was $528. So most groups running significant and well-thought-out OBS programs end up coming up with some process to give the patients relief for the self-administered medications. They either don't charge for them, or perhaps they have the patients take their home medications or come up with some other creative process.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gronovsky, and to you as well, Dr. Osborne, for being here and talking with us about this. It's not a topic that I think very many of us know that much about, but it's going to be incredibly important, particularly as payer models continue to shift over the coming years. And the distribution of patients that we see is always going to include these patients who may not be able to go home, but aren't slam dunks for admission either. So this is a podcast that I think some of those folks out there might need to listen to a couple of times to get through all of the terminology. It certainly was a brand new topic for me.
And all those listeners out there, thank you so much for giving us your time today. You can find the rest of our ASEP Equal series through the Academic Life in Emergency Medicine feed through Apple Podcasts. You can read our associated blog posts at www.aliem.com. You can find me on Twitter at jwoodsmd or via email at littlepatientsbigmedicine@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening.